Okay, let's resume equanimously to some extent. How was that for you? What did you experience, for better or worse, during those practices? The equanimity sampler. All right.
The one thing I want to share is that for me, my model.
Okay. So for you, an exemplar of equanimity is President Obama.
Yes.
Right. Thank you. Others? Yeah, right there.
Well, one thing that I noticed is when I got really quiet and little reactions would happen, either to your voice or something going on, that I could feel a certain amount of suffering in that that I think I'd totally miss in normal life that is probably going on all the time.
His comment was that he noticed as his that as his mind grew quieter, he could detect even more subtle forms of suffering that would be based on reacting to fairly small things, momentary things, like the sound of my voice, you know, coming in after a moment, after some time of quiet, or an event in the room, or maybe even an internal thought of something. And there was a realization there that illustrates the fact that that kind of quiet murmuring of suffering in the background is going on most of the time. And I think that's actually really true, which is one reason for the Buddha's emphasis, really, on steadiness of mind and deepening the capacity to see clearly and steadily and to gradually quiet the mind and live in such a way that the mind gets quiet so we can pick up this subtler granularity of suffering, which, as we'll get to in a moment, is gradually stitching neural structure together. Because, as we'll say, neurons that fire together, wire together. I thought of doing a rap song, but then I intelligently and wisely let that go. But we'll get more into that in a moment, but you're exactly right. All right, maybe one more person? Yeah, in the back?
Yeah, on that point of neurons that fire together, wire together, for me it had been so long since I sat like that, and being in a space where everybody was sitting, and
yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think everyone heard you, but just in case, the power really of sitting together in community. And as the Buddha said, you know, the three jewels, right? One of the three jewels is community, right? Both the vertical dimension of teachers and others that we respect who are kind of further along, as well as the horizontal dimension of the congregation or the gathering, you know, in the sense. Yeah, totally true. And as social animals, we're very entrained by the vibe. I suspect people will discover subtle energy fields, you know, 5 years from now or 500 years from now that also support that entrainment when multiple people come together. But there really is something that happens in a group. If I could just call out a little point, and I appreciate the fact that no one has yet complained about the sampler nature of that meditation, in the sense that I was asking you about, you know, once a minute, roughly, to try something new in your mind. And that can be kind of irritating.
Hard.
You know, right? Or hard, as people say, and it's really true. I really acknowledge that. And there's plenty of place for not doing that. But in fact, just kind of relaxing and letting things fall away and just have a fairly minimal activity in the mind. On the other hand, the Buddha really stressed wise effort, where we take action, both to release and lessen and prevent the unwholesome, pragmatically defined, not moralistically defined, the unwholesome in terms of what creates suffering and harm. And also, we are to be active to encourage and foster and increase and sustain that which is wholesome. So there's an activity, if you will. There's an active dimension. And to some extent, I liken the mind and the brain to a big jukebox, you know, with lots of stored songs. Most, you know, a lot of them are laments, right? I've been cheated and mistreated. When will I be loved? When will Rick stop singing? That's another song. But anyway, and then life goes, and we have these big buttons, right? And people bump up against them, or a thought arises that hits that button, and that song starts playing. And if that song's playing, those neurons are firing, and therefore they're wiring, you know, incrementally, bit by bit, sometimes more than incrementally, stitching that suffering, if you will, those second darts, you know, into the fabric of the brain and the self. On the other hand, there are also good songs, right? Good experiences, for example, recollections of strength, or things that make us feel grateful, or the sense of being with people who care about us, and so forth. And it's great to become increasingly able to push those buttons too, and to become increasingly adept with wise effort to both kind of protect and the buttons that play those painful songs, and gradually get those songs off the hard drive, right? And increasingly get adept at playing the buttons that promote good songs, and to the degree that they become increasingly our natural state. And we don't even have to make a conscious effort to play those buttons. So getting more skillful at the jukebox, the inner jukebox, you know, is in some ways the essence of wise effort, which is one of the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is an active practice. Again, I think something that's happened, in my personal opinion, as Buddhism came to the West, its more passive aspects were emphasized. But in the actual Dharma from the Buddha, he's really quite active. His own life was very active in terms of his movement up to realization, and he was quite an innovator. He kept innovating during the whole 40 years of his teaching. Someone came up to me at the break with another innovation, and I just love it when people innovate, you know, because he innovated. Different things work for different people. Right. So there's a place for being active. Yeah, one person?
Yes. At the end of the last session, we were talking about getting boinked.
Boinked, yeah, by life.
Acknowledging that you experienced a victimization, or et cetera. And I think that several questions came about acceptance. And now we're talking about an active modality that the Buddha is stressing. I think in my own life, I often find that this acceptance that we are beginning to be taught over and over, and the letting, I'm concerned that it actually shuts me down from being active. And I don't know, I suppose you will talk about this, but since you are talking about this being active, how do you not let it shut you down? You know, this acceptance.
Thank you. So if I can do justice to your subtle, complex point there in question, and correct me if I don't, okay? Let's see, on the one hand, there is an element of acceptance in practice, recognition of the facts, right? There I was walking in the crosswalk, the light was green, and wham, I got bonked. Something happened, right? Or more complex, but actually more realistic, I was in a situation and, yeah, I did this little thing that wasn't the wisest, coolest, whatever thing, most Obama-like or what have you, thing moves, whatever thing, and yet, wow, whew, man, all kinds of first darts started getting thrown at me that are way out of proportion to my part of the matter. Right, then it's more complex. Okay, so I think the trick is, of course, around balance. And that's where I like the idea of riding a bicycle, because we're always correcting. We're always tacking or correcting. We're always falling over one way or another. So there are pitfalls in being too accepting. And that's where you were getting at. That movement toward acceptance, in a sense of, the way I'm using that, it's like recognizing the way it is. It doesn't mean we endorse it. It doesn't mean we agree with it or give it our blessing. We simply go, wow, there I was in the crosswalk, whamola, dude was drunk and I'm in the hospital now, in a body cast or whatever, right? So we can go too far with acceptance. In a sense, we can get stuck there, as I said earlier, that's why I did those three phases, because that's, for me, a useful model. We can get stuck in the first phase. Like, there I am, you know, including we can get stuck with acceptance with our own mind states. There I am, depressed again. Here I am, anxious again. I guess I'm just an anxious person. You know, we can get caught there. On the other hand, we can blow right by acceptance way too fast. Me, you know, like, ooh, I want to fix it, I want to solve it, I want to move on. So my correction, internally, my bicycle riding myself, has been to really be internally suspicious of my movement to solve, because I'm adept at that. You know, I'm good at the second and third phase, right? So in a lot of ways, it's kind of a great teaching. You know, the stuff where we often get caught by is what we're really good at, because we don't tend to realize how we're caught by it. We're quite aware of what we're not so good at, and da-da, and then we often correct around it. But to be carried away by our strengths, you know, that often happens for people. Sorry? Okay, so for me, that's the essence of the matter. If I could, just in the interest of time, I want to go back to something that I went right by, which is where equanimity is in Buddhist practice, and kind of call out four aspects of it, and then bounce forward again to talking about you know, self-directed neuroplasticity and all the rest of that. I should add that my email address is on the very first slide, and I'm fairly easy to get a hold of. I am going on retreat Wednesday night for most of June, holy moly, and so, you know, please help me go on retreat. And just know I may not be able to respond immediately to you, especially if you email me after Wednesday night. Okay. But anyway, if questions arise, which are natural, because we just don't have time for them, especially with a large group, you know, I'm open to you contacting me or connecting with me. And I'll stick around during lunch and the break and a little bit thereafter. All right. So equanimity in Buddhist practice. There's some major places that equanimity shows up that it's fundamentally central. First of all, it's one of the four Brahma-viharas. Brahma-viharas could be translated as Brahma is like the divine, and vihara is abode, or, you know, resting place. So these are divine states of mind, if you will, and they are in Buddhism fourfold: compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, in other words, joy at the good fortune of others. It's the opposite of Schadenfreude, which is joy at the misery of others. All right, and fourth, equanimity. And it's said, actually, that equanimity is the most important of the four because it's really the condition for sustaining the other three. It's hard to sustain compassion or sustain kindness or sustain altruistic joy if our, you know, boat is capsized in the water and we're really upset or really overwhelmed or really flooded. All right. And part of equanimity is to see that, you know, really things, all kinds of things happen. All kinds of causes and conditions come and go. And on the basis of that, one can have, you know, an inexhaustible and fountain of compassion and good wishes toward other people around us. Second, equanimity is a paramita. Paramitas are the attributes of a bodhisattva, someone who is highly developed, if not entirely awakened, and who still remains in the world to help bring other beings across the river of suffering. This notion of the paramis or paramitas came in after the Buddha's death, basically. It's a nice addition, though. There are different lists. Some have six, some have 10. On all those lists is equanimity. So it's one of the attributes of a bodhisattva. Equanimity is also very embedded in the third and the fourth jhanas. These are states of deep, non-ordinary concentration and absorption and non-ordinary states of awareness that are what is the eighth element of the Noble Eightfold Path, right concentration or wise concentration. And this slide is the original text, and you can see in the third and fourth listing there that equanimity is very present. They really characterize those states of deep absorption, which then fosters, as he was saying, the capacity to see ever more clearly, you know, in the spotlight of awareness. Okay, and then last, did I do that? We'll go back. And equanimity is one of the seven factors of awakening. If I can remember, they come in different sequences. If I can remember this one sequence, there's mindfulness, which leads to investigation, which leads to energy, which leads to bliss, rapture, bliss, which leads to tranquility, which leads to equanimity. I forgot one. See, there I go. But there's one more. But anyway, trust me, equanimity is in those factors, and it's one of the good ones. Okay? So you could see equanimity in Buddhist practice. So there are two aspects here. Equanimity comes from insight, and then equanimity is enacted in practice. Okay? Great. So I'd like to talk now about why the brain matters on the path of awakening. Why should we actually care, right? So, this is the most intellectually dense slide I've got. I think when you're dealing with something messy and complicated, and also one with full of historical, religious, you know, complications, it's good to define your terms. So, by mind, I mean something fairly prosaic. The flow of information through the nervous system, which is headquartered in the brain. The nervous system sends signals. It moves signals around in some senses, like the heart moves blood around. All right? Most of that information is forever outside of awareness. It's completely below the waterline. What bubbles up into conscious awareness is just the tip of the iceberg. Okay? We privilege it, excessively in fact, because it's what we're aware of. It's kind of an equivalent, I was saying to someone earlier, of Eurocentrism. You know, in the 500 years ago, they didn't know there were other places in the world, right? And yet there's this growing awareness, whoa, there's a whole continent out there, North, Central, and South America. Wow. Three continents, if you want to call it that. So what's below the waterline is where we plant the seeds of suffering or happiness, right? Helpfulness or harm. That's what really matters. So apart from hypothetical, possible transcendental factors, in a sense, the mind is what the brain does. Okay, it's kind of, at one level, you know, a person could think, well, of course, what else? Because if it's not transcendental, what is it? But on the other hand, it's startling to make it intimate. Like right now, what's to just reflect on, like, your experience of listening, seeing, sights, sounds, and all the rest of that is always a construction in the nervous system that's only a partial representation of real objective reality, presuming there is such a thing. And that is my presumption here. Okay? But to realize and get, wow, all this is basically just a movie playing, you know? Without needing to be dualistic about it, that there's a watcher or a director, an auteur, you know? There's just a movie continually running, continually constructed by this extraordinary brain. Wow, it gets really weird and real and intimate and wonderful all at once just to do that. So in effect, the brain is the necessary condition for the mind. No brain, no mind. No brain, no pain, right? No brain, no mind. It's proximally sufficient. It's sufficient, but it's only proximally sufficient because the brain is nested in the nervous system, which is intertwined with other bodily systems, which is intertwined with the whole world of nature and culture, both in present time and over the deep time of evolution. Okay. But that said, effectively, the brain is the necessary and sufficient condition for the mind. All right? So now, let's talk about the brain kind of quickly in passing. This is the technical specifications, as it were. It's kind of amazing. You know, inside the head, 1.1 trillion cells, right? 100 billion of them are neurons, a trillion are support cells that are very helpful, including in terms of moving information around. This brain is always on 24/7, kind of like the refrigerator, because it's got to be able to, you know, like something wakes you up, but boom, you got to be able to operate, right? Something happens, woof, you got to be able to deal. So because it's so busy, even though it's only about 2 to 3% of body weight, it uses 20 to 25% of the metabolic supplies in the body, right? 20 to 25% of the glucose and oxygen circulating in the blood. One reason it's using all those supplies is that, boy, is it busy. Typical neurons are firing together. I'll show you a typical neuron. 5 to 50 times a second. All right? And each time they fire, they, in most cases, they release little bubbles called vesicles of molecules of neurotransmitters like serotonin, which is a target of Prozac and other antidepressants, as well as numerous other neurotransmitters, into the space of the synapse, where they're taken up by this receiving downstream neuron. In this slide, the receiving end, in most cases, is on the left side as you face it. Those are the dendrites. They reach out. And then the long wire, if you will, is the axon, which then sends a signal to downstream receiving neurons. A typical neuron connects with about 5,000 other neurons. So it kind of gets crazy. You start punching the numbers on the calculator. 100 billion neurons, 5,000 connections. What is that? That's 500 trillion little synapses inside the head. Right? A neuron, the cell body is pretty big. You could put five of them side by side in the width of your hair, one hair. Five neurons side by side, the cell bodies. But the synapses are super tiny. You could put 5,000 of them side by side in the width of a single hair. Right? So think about it. If you've got 500 trillion synapses, and neurons are typically firing 5 to 50 times a second, a fair amount of that firing is noise. Changes in the firing rate are signal that carry information. So not all the firing is signal. But even if you just kind of say, hey, there's not that, you know, there's a lot of noise, not even that much signal. The bottom line, see, if you have 500 trillion neurons firing, let's say on an average, maybe 5 times a second, in the space of a single breath or the ringing of the bell, a quadrillion signals, a quadrillion bits, zeros and ones, if you will, bits of information moved between your ears. Wow. This takes me personally to awe and responsibility, gratitude and responsibility. Like, holy moly. I mean, the build out of the brain was just kind of handed to you, the instructions on the day you were conceived. I once threatened our children that, you know, we were going to videotape their conception and play it at their 21st birthday party. But we passed on that idea. It's not a good idea. But anyway, man, conception, wham, the DNA gets structured. It's got the build out in it. No one could earn that gift. All right, that's enabling us to sit here and do this today. On the other hand, responsibility. What will we do with that gift? That's where wise effort comes in. What will we do moment to moment to moment? You know, the Tibetans say, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. That's what's under our control, the next minute. And do we go to the high end or the low end of the range of what's possible, minute by minute by minute, as we move through the lifespan, right? And what we choose moment by moment by moment, the high end or the low end of the range of what's possible. And that range goes up and down, depending on whether it's a good moment like this or whether you've just been hit by somebody in a crosswalk, right? But what we do at that moment, up or down, moment by moment, that increment, that delta, if you will, of choices, gradually determines whether the course of our life is like this or like that or even like that. We will inherit the results of those choices moment by moment by moment, and those inclinations of mind. So what we're doing, I think, more than anything else, moment by moment by moment, is trying to sow the seeds of wholesome tendencies to help us keep moving toward the high end of that range, you know, moment by moment. As I said to my wife last night about something different involving a choice she made, I said, you know, no one ever regrets taking the high road at the high end of the range of what's possible. Okay. So let's see, back to the brain. I think I've made most of these points. So if you've got, you know, 100 billion neurons, they're either firing or not. It's kind of simple at the basic level, green light or red light, right? Or in this fact, excite or inhibit. That's the meaning of their firing. You know, gas pedal or brakes, excite or inhibit. 100 billion neurons, either, you know, exciting or inhibiting, on or off, that gives you, in effect, 10 to the millionth possible brain states. Now, to put that number in perspective, that's one followed by a million zeros. There are only 10 to the 80th atoms in the universe, one followed by 80 zeros. So compare one followed by 80 zeros versus one followed by a million zeros. In other words, the brain is so far the most complex object known in the universe, more complex than an exploding star, more complex than the American economy, the healthcare system, you know, anyway, the mind of a teenager. Okay. So now, fact number one. We'll do three facts here. As the brain changes, the mind changes, for better or for worse. Caffeine, sugar, and water, and coolness on the left. Concussion on the right. All right? Brain changes, mind changes. Second fact, as the mind changes, the brain changes. This one's really cool and really important. In other words, the fleeting flow of mental activity, this information moving through the nervous system and brain, is continually changing the brain as it sweeps by. All right? It does so both temporarily and in lasting ways. Let's look at some pictures of temporary changes in the brain based on changes in the mind. This is a Tibetan monk doing boundless compassion meditation. This is a side shot of his brain. He's looking in this direction, like that. And the part that's lit up, looks like a kind of a caterpillar or a campfire, is the anterior, which means frontal, cingulate cortex, which is a part of the brain that's involved in the conscious control of attention, which understandably would be activated in meditation. Just a heads up, it looks like everything else has gone dark and quiet, right? But in fact, that part is just about 2% more metabolically active. But that 2% difference corresponds to, in a meaningful sense, the nature of the mental activity right then and there, and makes a lot of difference over time. To check out another one, this is a shot of a head sliced this way of a college student who's head over heels in love, being shown a picture of his or her sweetheart. And that part of the brain, if you can see it, is the caudate nucleus, which is part of the reward system in the basal ganglia in the limbic system. And no surprise, that person who's just besotted is just going, wow, and seeing a picture of one sweetheart. On the one hand, of course, the takeaway question for people in longer relationships is, does that still happen? And for many people, those intense rewards tend to become more subtle and diffuse, let's say, and yet still very, very meaningful. It's also the case that some couples who've been in long-term marriages and have the gray hair to prove it, also when put through the scanner, still have that same reward light up when they see a picture of their sweetheart. So I find that personally hopeful. The trick is not to crave it, but to hope for it or aspire to it. All right. Sow the seeds of it. Okay. Christian nuns recalling profound spiritual experiences. Interestingly, some of the same areas lit up. Notably, in the upper left-hand slide, the LACC, left anterior cingulate cortex. So they're doing focused attentional practices inside an MRI. Excuse me. I also want to draw your attention to two other parts of their brain that lit up. One is the insula. That is the, you see that in the second to the right in the top row slide. The insula is a part of the brain that's involved in embodied experience, really being in touch with your body. And a third part that's lit up is our friend the caudate nucleus. In the third from the left slide in the upper column, or upper row rather, you see L caudate. And then in the far right one in the top row, you see R caudate, right caudate. I find it quite interesting that these nuns, Christian nuns, in other words, women, are both having a more embodied quality to this spiritual experience and also a more intensely rewarding one. It's not that it's better or worse, but by understanding something of the hardware, that can kind of illuminate in a way that seems to make sense, right, intuitive sense, that it illuminates the mental experience that they're having right then and there. Okay? It's not to be totally reductionistic and make them the same or different, but to just, because truthfully, the granularity of an MRI is about a millimeter on a side, and in that millimeter, there are tens of thousands, maybe millions of synapses packed into there, and also its time resolution, its temporal resolution is only, a couple of seconds, really, at a crack. So it's like looking at little microbes with a very low-power microscope. You can see some amazing things, but we're going to see a lot more amazing things and a lot more resolution and detail as the technology improves over the next 10 years or 1,000 years. All right, moving on. Just a couple more examples of how mental activity changes neural activity. This was a study done in Japan. College students who were told first, in the study had two phases, that there was someone in their class who was just like them and spectacularly more successful. So they self-reported painful envy in the scanner, and they also lit up networks that have to do with both physical and emotional pain, which illustrates a broader point that, or another point, rather, that quote-unquote higher functions, if you will, like social pain, are built up by Mother Nature and evolution on lower circuitry. Right? Social pain overlaps a lot with neural pain, or physical pain, rather, in terms of its neural networks. And then in the second phase of the study, they were told that their nemesis, who was so much more successful in whatever than they were, had experienced a humiliating and spectacular downfall. And then they reported lovely pleasure of Schadenfreude. And the pleasure circuits of the brain also lit up, both physical and social pleasure. All right? Without getting into the detail of this, again, it illustrates the point. Mental activity maps in ways that are quite subtle and wonderfully interesting to physical neural activity. Okay? So the takeaway here, obviously, is that the mind changes the brain. But it doesn't just do it temporarily. It does it in lasting ways, which is really where we're very, very interested today. In other words, for example, busy regions get more blood. They get more supplies. In other words, as cities grow, more transportation, you know, pipelines come into them. Also, amazingly, the genetic expression of different neurons and different aspects in the body is altered by mental activity. Gene expression has to do with the ways in which little strips of atoms in the longer tangled molecule of DNA are either suppressed or inhibited in their activation or turbocharged or unleashed, if you will, so they really have an impact. For example, people who routinely do relaxation training have been found to have improved expression of the genes that control the stress reaction response. All right? In other words, they don't get so triggered by stressful events. Isn't that remarkable that just kind of taking big breaths and imagining puffy white clouds alters the activity of little strips of atoms inside larger molecules? That's epigenetics, so-called. And then last, kind of building on the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, you know, is the great line, neurons that fire together wire together, as I said previously. In other words, busy neurons become even more sensitive to stimulation. Existing synapses get strengthened. New structure gets built, and I'll show you a slide of that in a moment. And there's also neuronal pruning, or what some people call neural Darwinism, survival of the busiest, right? Use it or lose it. For example, a slide of that that's probably near and dear to the meditators in the room is that a study showed that over a long period of meditative practice, that the more you meditate, the more you build out three regions of the brain. The one and two are particularly important. Number one is the insula, that part of the brain I mentioned before that has to do with tracking the state of the body. It's also very involved in self-awareness, and it's very involved in empathy. I won't get much into the social brain, if you will. I'll do a workshop here with Rick Mendias, my neurologist friend and teaching partner, in July about that. But the insula is great. The insula is really important for all kinds of things. Interestingly, and not surprisingly, people who routinely do a mindfulness practice, and these were, I think, Buddhist meditators, but they're in the real world, you know, with a messy, typical history of mindfulness practice, not perfect practice. They also built out the executive systems, number two of the brain, related to the anterior cingulate cortex, that control attention. And then third, there was some increase in, or thickening. These regions of the brain got thicker in terms of synaptic structures and layers. Also an increase, number three, in the somatosensory regions. Probably they're getting also some kind of benefit tuning into their body. All right? It's also true, interestingly, if you look at the slides in the bottom, that instead of the usual cortical thinning that occurs with age, we normally lose about 10,000 brain cells a day. So that by around age 80, you know, we've lost 3 to 5%, you know, cortical volume. There's normal cortical thinning with age. But in these three regions, the folks who are the blue dots, the meditators, were straight line. In other words, they did not lose cortical thickness. The people in the who are the red squares lost cortical thickness and experienced normal cortical thinning in these regions due to aging. I think there's some very interesting implications here for, you know, aging, dementia, population, and so forth. There are no really developed studies about it, but the early indications are fairly promising. Why not? You know, and it's also never too late to start. You know, synapses started forming in the third trimester of a fetus inside the womb, maybe even sooner. And as long as there's oxygen flow in the brain, there's neural activity even after your last breath. And so I kind of think about it sometimes myself, after the last breath, you know, as the lights slowly go out in the mansion of the brain and the mind, in the last few minutes, still some structures maybe are forming. Some learning, if you will, is still happening, even as those final lights go out. Okay. There was a question there? No? Keep moving. Okay. So, I want to say a few more things, then I'll open it up for discussion, okay? So, takeaway point, you know, or as Minsky says here, brains change themselves. The takeaway point is you can use your mind to change your brain, to change your mind for the better. And that, right there, is self-directed neuroplasticity, and I think it's fantastically hopeful. First, though, some perspectives, because this stuff's in the news a lot these days, and I think there's a little bit of hoo-ha out there, a little bit of smoke and mirrors about some of this brain stuff mixed in, a little bit of bathwater mixed in with these wonderful babies, all right? So first of all, neuroplasticity is not breaking news. It's sometimes posited as if, oh my God, we've just discovered neuroplasticity. For several centuries, certainly in Western science, and perhaps even longer, it's been presumed that, in ways that are completely mysterious, mental activity has got to change neural structure. Otherwise, how could anybody learn anything new? All right? The breaking news is in the previous slide, if you will, the details of how, all right, as well as other stuff that I didn't have room for on this slide. All right? Most neuroplasticity is incremental. That's what really matters. The neuroplasticity, for example, of the practice you did before the break, right, was changing neural structure. Those meditators were gradually thickening the insula and the executive systems of the brain for attention. Now, awareness heightens neural structure building. Yes, neurons that fire together wire together outside the field of awareness, but what's within the field of awareness is accelerated in terms of structure formation. That makes sense because we want organisms, creatures, or ancestors to learn from what they're aware of, right? Residues of conscious experience, including subtle murmurs in the background of the mind, very subtle granular ones, gradually sift into implicit memory, which is memory for the lived residues of experience. And that forms the basis of our expectations, our attitudes, our moods, our, you know, implicit assumptions about ourself, the world, others, past and the future. Takeaway point, for me, one of the major takeaway points from all this brain stuff is experience really matters. It's made me much more sensitive to being a good steward. That's where we started today in the meditative practice, self-compassion and getting on your own side. You know, being a good steward for what sits inside the mind. The analogy here, and I hope it's not offensive to anyone, having grown up with dogs and cleared a fair amount of waste matter, I think of a dog, you know, a temple dog, wandering into the temple, this beautiful temple, beautiful floor, etc., and leaving some waste behind. And then you come into the room, right? It's there. You accept it, in a sense. There it is. It's a fact. But what do? We want to remove it. We don't want to let it sit there for a long period of time, in part because it might stain the floor, let alone the aroma left behind, right? Same thing with the mind. Think of all the stuff we just let sit in our head way past that first phase of mindful awareness, way past the point of usefulness, or the amount of just murmuring where we generate, you know, the dog do, frankly. We self-generate in our own head, which just sits in the temple of the mind, gradually, you know, besides altering the atmosphere, gradually leaving stains behind, because neurons that fire together wire together. It's a big, big takeaway point. And in working with people, in as clients, I find this is probably the number one benefit of the brain stuff, applying neuroscience into the helping professions, because it's motivating. It helps people appreciate that there are results for what they do and that it's important in a whole other kind of level or a whole other kind of way to really be, you know, good stewards of, you know, what kind of thoughts and feelings they routinely indulge. Okay, including what runs in the background in the simulator, if you will. Because what's in the simulator is wiring and therefore firing away. That's one reason why mindfulness is really important, to become aware, you know, of what's there in the background. So mindfulness helps us be aware of what's in the background. It also turbocharges learning. In other words, because neuroplasticity is heightened for what's in the focal field of attention, in other words, that gets sucked right into the fabric of the brain, directing attention skillfully is probably the preeminent way to gradually alter the conditions of suffering and of happiness that are embedded in the brain. You know, as William James said, the education of attention, of course, is an education par excellence. So questions or comments so far? Yeah, the man and then the woman behind you, yeah.
Given this slide, how would you define mindfulness?
That's a great question. How would I define mindfulness? Because again, that word is pretty elastic, right? Attention itself is not mindfulness, and it's interesting that in Buddha Dharma, there are very clear distinctions made among these various things. I think of fundamentally mindfulness boiling down to three things. First, there is a quality of, you know, of awareness. There is awareness of something. Second, there's a spaciousness around it. I think that's where Jon Kabat-Zinn and MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, has really emphasized the important point of a quality of acceptance, to use her word earlier, and even friendliness. There's a spaciousness around it. We hold it in a big space. A nice traditional metaphor is if you take a tablespoon of salt and dump it in a cup of water, stir it around and drink it, ooh, lots of unpleasant feeling tones, right? Maybe some craving to get rid of the cup. On the other hand, if you take that same amount of salt, the same amount of pain, the same amount of sorrow, the same amount of fear or anger or upset or reaction to someone who just is not terribly kind at an intersection, you know, some Saturday morning, and pour it into a clean bucket of water or even a lake full of water, stir it around and drink, you'll hardly taste the salt at all. I think that's one reason, that's one thing that mindfulness really does for it. It's like the jumbo bucket, you know, in which the salt exists. And then last, an attribute of mindfulness is its sustained nature. The root of the word for mindfulness in Pali, in the language of early Buddhism, is recollectedness. Recollectedness. We're continually recalling. And to put it a little differently, we're not forgetting ourselves. We're not doing things forgetfully or heedlessly. There's an ongoing quality of recollectedness. There's a steadiness of mind. So those three attributes, and then there are supporting conditions and so forth, but those three attributes, right? Awareness, spaciousness, and steadiness or recollectedness, I think really get at the essence of mindfulness. Okay?
So I don't want to get too technical, but I'm interested in the brain changes, so you're getting neuronal thickening.
Yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely. So, a restate. As we do practices, including relaxation practices or other equanimity practices, is there a growing structuring, a growing embedding in the brain and also in the other tissues of the body of a kind of dampening of stress reactions, including the hormonal cascades which come from stress? Absolutely. And after lunch, I'll talk more about that and how to promote that. Maybe a couple more? Yeah.
I have the skill of being mindful and have had the experience of choosing to come to the positive. And yet I notice that there are times when I will mindfully actually watch my mind choose to go to the negative. And will you be talking a little about why we make that choice?
Great question.
Know better?
So there can be that experience where we're mindfully aware of our own reaction. We're even mindfully aware of the knowing of the bad results that will happen from indulging in that reaction. We're even mindfully aware of the voice, like in you know, the second Star Wars movie, "Pull up, it's a trap," you know. Right? Or "Don't go there. Don't say that stupid thing." And then bloop. Right? Well, totally true, right? So this afternoon more, we'll talk more about how to do that and how to plant the seeds, increasingly helping oneself do it. What helps me with that is to think about kind of four stages of learning. And stage one is you're doing it and you don't even know you're doing it. You're coming home and kicking the dog and you don't even know you're kicking the dog, right? You're just doing it. Stage two, you're aware of doing it. Usually you wish you wouldn't do it, but you can't help yourself. You still go there, right? Second stage is the hardest stage of all. Third stage, the tendency arises to do it, right? To kick the dog or feel, you know, to beat yourself up in your head yet again or whatever the reaction tendency is, and you don't do it. That's the third stage. And then the fourth stage, the tendency doesn't even arise, right? And it's nice to kind of think of those stages, I think, or to use phrases even from the business world that I like because they're kind of a quick and clever summary. Stage one is unconscious incompetence. Like, for example, you can't ride a bike and you're a little kid, you don't even know bikes exist. Stage two is conscious incompetence. You're trying to ride the darn bike and you keep falling over. Stage three is conscious competence, where you're riding the bike, but boy, you got to bring a lot of conscious attention to it. The analogy, I think, to driving a car in the very beginning is a good one. And then the fourth stage is unconscious competence, where you just automatically can ride that bike. So I think the trick and the hard part of practice, first is to, a lot of us are aware. If you're in this room, you're aware of second darts and reactions and stuff like that. The trick is to move from the second stage to the third stage, and then with practice, increasingly, as you were getting at in the back there, have that third stage become increasingly automatic and woven into just your natural inclination. I didn't have to work hard to smile and wave the person on at the intersection, because that was fairly easy, and it was an easy challenge. It wasn't, you know, someone in my family snarking on me. You know, that's, I think it levels of challenge. That, you know, the one at the intersection, you know, was like on the 0 to 10 scale of challenge was probably like a 0.8 or 0.5, you know. It's low grade. But anyway, you find that more and more you just naturally don't react. Okay, maybe one more person that I want to move on. How about from this side of the room? How about you right there? Yeah, you caught me, didn't you? I'm okay. Yeah. So if I can do justice to me, perhaps the ultimate, really profound matter, question about the place of the transcendental, if you will, and what I meant by that, and you know, and all that.
In relationship
to mind, including particularly conscious awareness, probably, because that's where people really get involved with that. Yeah. Well, first to frame, people have different views about this, and to respect diversity of view. Some views are that the transcendental, by whatever name, God, the, you know, the ground, the nameless, Buddha nature in some meanings of that term, is absolutely inextricably woven into the flow of mind, or the, you know, the, certainly what's in conscious awareness. Other people are on the other side. They just don't think that's true at all. They think that in ways that remain, that are quite mysterious, the meat makes the mind. And that's their view. And then there are people who are kind of more in the middle and aren't sure and kind of holding both possibilities. So I just want to be cool about allowing people to be in any one of those three spots. And then we can move forward in a practical matter down here. Now he's asking me, where am I? Aha. Well, I'll say something first, then I'll answer your question. Second, with regard to the transcendental, it could well be true that it is in play and it's calling us home. It's calling us to our nature. It's calling us to the ground. It's calling us to love. You know, it's fascinating to me that across so many traditions and so many wide variations of culture, completely different people who really have had like transformative experiences, and it's not even clear that experiences is the right word, pretty much say the same thing about the ultimate nature, or that A, there is a transcendental, and B, that it's conscious and benign, and it's the ultimate happiness, if you will. All right, so it could well be that the transcendental is calling us home. It could also be, even without positing a transcendental, that a sense of the transcendental in the mind itself, that one accepts is constructed by the brain mysteriously in the mind itself, a sense of the transcendental, a belief in it, a hope in it, a hope for it, a faith in it, what have you, is really wholesome factors. And I think one of the things that's happened in clinical psychology, for example, which started out in a very, you know, whoa, we don't do religion here, there's a growing appreciation in the world of therapists that that spiritual life and spiritual communities of one kind or another, yes, there have been great harms that have rippled forward from that aspect of humanity. That said, for many people, spiritual life and spiritual community is a great psychological resource. Okay? So again, that. And then, so I'll answer your question, then I hope we can move on quickly. I'm a transcendentalist. You know, I think, for me it's plausible for various reasons I don't want to get into right now. I'll happily talk about it privately or, you know, offline. It's plausible that there really is an X factor, and that's also my experience of things. And I think it's possible that many years from now, I think it'll be centuries, if not millennia from now, scientists will have completely exhausted the possibilities of what the hardware can produce in terms of software, in terms of mind. And we'll have a worldwide press conference, you know, and say basically, we exhausted the possibilities, and brain makes mind in so many ways, and yet there is an irreducible mystery that we just bow to and shake our head and just hold up our hands. It reminds me of the cartoon you may have seen in the New Yorker of these like two scientist guys. They're men, of course, who, you know, we won't go there, but two scientist guys with squiggles on a chalkboard. You know, one guy's presenting his equation to the other guy and all these symbols and signs, mathematical formula. And at the very end, he has this little term in the equation. And then there was light. And they're both looking at it, you know, I don't know, you know, I kind of think that day may come. But until then, we got our work cut out in the trenches, in that second stage of growth where we're mindfully aware of the tendency arising and it still hijacks us yet again. You know, we have our work cut out. Whatever else we do, tie your camel. Okay. So. I think I dodged a bullet there. Look, I'll keep going, thankfully. All right, so moving right along, I want to talk about equanimity in the brain. Okay, and then I'm going to do some general methods, goodness gracious, and slide into lunch. All right? Okay, so equanimity in the brain. There are a few basic features because the brain did not evolve to be equanimous. Yes, that is its resting state, and I'll talk about that more after lunch. But wow, to be able to just kind of not react to the feeling tone, hold it in spaciousness, that's no way to keep squirrels, rats, crocodiles, and amoebas alive, right? And our ancestors, as we'll talk more later, they were all mellow and chill and equanimous. Shump! They got eaten because they were not nervous and irritable. Right, we are their great-grandchildren at the top of the food chain, right? The most nervous and irritable creatures on the planet, and really good at it, right? Armed with nuclear weapons in the 21st century. It's one reason why we really need to get better and more skillful at managing our own brain. So let's think about what is equanimity in a brain. Well, first there's understanding and intention, right? That's where insight comes in, and that's where intention comes in, to increasingly intend to, you know, move past the second stage to the third stage in terms of our own reaction streams, right? You can see the different parts of the brain where those intentions and ideas are held. It's important to appreciate, I think, that intention and understanding is both top-down, but arguably more importantly, it's bottom-up. Embodied in the feeling, woven into the inner fabric, based on many moments of seed planting, right? That's also where understanding and intention live. Second major factor is steadiness of mind. You know, If the mind is not steady, it's super hard to sustain equanimity because we get hijacked. We don't even realize it. We forget ourselves. We lose that recollectedness. And that's initially sustained by top-down executive control, mingly from the anterior cingulate cortex. I showed you that picture earlier. And interestingly, over time, I suspect in deep stages of practice, including where I think many people got to by the end of the practice we did before the break, the anterior cingulate cortex kind of falls away in terms of its directedness, in terms of applying and sustaining attention, and there's more of a whole body, ongoing, self-reinforcing loop of stable, spacious awareness. Just to show you an illustration of that, let's take a look at the description of the jhanas from the Buddha and notice what happens in the transition from the first to the second jhana. Here we go. In the first jhana, there is applied and sustained thought. That is applying attention and sustaining attention to the object of awareness. That's the anterior cingulate cortex's preeminent job description. But notice what happens by the second jhana. Applied and sustained thought falls away. That suggests to me that at that point, top-down control from the anterior cingulate falls away. And in ways that are very interesting, there's a steadiness of mind that persists without much, if any, at all, top-down control. Which also gets at a larger point, which is that I take these descriptions, which are really in plain English. Sometimes it helps for a little bit of clarification. What does that mean, applied or sustained? When they mean by thought, they pretty much mean attention. These are plain English descriptions of psychological or mental states that must map to underlying neural activity. Right? Because the mind is what the brain does, in addition to whatever God is doing. All right? If anything at all. And so it's really interesting to do the reverse engineering. In other words, to think, okay, what in the world could be going on in a brain when you move from the first to the second jhana? Because that's interesting. Why doesn't the person become super distracted? But in fact, their attention becomes more stable than ever. I don't have a good answer to that question. But you could see the illustration here of the larger point, to work backwards, to look at these mental descriptions, psychological descriptions, because the Buddha and his contemporaries did not have access to information about the black box, and then ask oneself, what could be going on inside the black box that I can stimulate, and therefore, by stimulating it, getting those neurons to fire together, I can strengthen it by getting those neurons to wire together. Okay? So then, fast forward, back to equanimity in the brain. There we go. Global coherence, I think that's one of the things that happens, particularly as people move out of top-down control of attention, in that there's this growing sense of unification of awareness as just one whole percept. You might have experienced that toward the end of the meditation this morning, of there just being an ongoing sense of the wholeness of experience, all present here now, resting as a body breathing simply, here, and here, and here. And in the brain, that probably corresponds to a lot of gamma wave activity. Gamma waves are fast waves that reflect the fact that you're getting very fast synchronization of whole neural assemblies, 30 to 80 times a second. You know, they're beating or clapping in rhythm with each other, spreading over large swaths of neural real estate. And that state corresponds in MRI studies to deep states of presence and attentiveness and steadiness of mind, and increase in their kind of appearance as traits, because there's this movement from state to trait, from stimulating to strengthening, in people who have long-term meditative practices. For those of you that, for example, have a fairly established and long-term practice, I bet you that in your brain, fairly routinely, you drop into more gamma wave, large scale unification and coherence than A, you did 5, 10, 20 years ago, and B, than most people do routinely. And that's kind of good news, you know? Last, common contentment, a real central aspect, including contentment. There's a lot of relaxation, a lot of parasympathetic activation. That's the part of the autonomic nervous system that puts the brakes on the stress response, fight or flight, sympathetic nervous system. Also, there's a lot less stress hormones in equanimity, and people who are increasingly equanimous don't have those stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, which take a long time to metabolize. Haven't you had an experience where you were afraid something bad was going to happen, and then you realize that, no, it was nothing at all, but 20 minutes later, your body's so kind of jacked up? It's because literally it takes a while to metabolize cortisol, you know, and detox it, essentially, and move it through and out the door, all right? And as well, with calm and contentment, there is an underlying well-being in the three motivational systems I alluded to in the very beginning today. The system of avoiding, you know, threats and pain, sticks, the system of approaching, opportunities, pleasure, and carrots, and the system for attaching to us. Okay. So, one question, and then we'll move on, and then we'll have lunch. Please.
Can you talk briefly to the dietary factors that most constrict or most inhibit this process, whether caffeine or sugar or whatever?
Yes. So the question was, can I talk about diet, probably broadly defined, in terms of how what it has to do with equanimity, right? So let's see here. We've all noticed, or most of us have at least, on the one hand, what a lot of caffeine does to equanimity, and on the other hand, what alcohol, let's say, does to equanimity. In the beginning, alcohol probably increases equanimity because it can dampen stress reaction, but then obviously it can have people become disinhibited so they don't have wholesome control. Remember the first pillar of practice? Sila, restraint, virtue. They don't, you know, there's a wonderful Chinese proverb, you know, person takes drink, drink takes person. You know, and that movement from person takes drink, you know, to be careful about. On the other, additionally, it's interesting, the appendix in the book I wrote, Buddha's Brain, written by my wife as a clinical nutritionist, has a lot of research-based information about how people can promote the neural substrate of positive states of mind and less anxiety and less, you know, depression through well-done nutrients that are targeted that you can get at a health food store. I won't get into that right now, but there's that book, other good books have that kind of information out there as well. Generally, I think that, you know, like three domains of intervention, intervening in the body is a good thing. Most of us know what will help our bodies better. Protein with every meal, all right? Choosing foods wisely. A lot of people are allergic to the classes of foods that were introduced late in the human diet, just in the last 10,000 years, namely gluten, grains, and milk products. You know, be careful about caffeine. Be careful about alcohol, other drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Take good care of yourself and exercise. Talk about neuroplasticity. I didn't have in there what's called neurogenesis, which is that it's only recently been discovered that new neurons are born every day in the human brain. Lots of neurons are born every day in lower animals. The further you go up as it were, metaphorically, the evolutionary ladder, the less neurogenesis there is. But it's recently been found that human beings typically produce about 1,000 new neurons a day, mainly in the hippocampus, a part of the brain that's involved in, no surprise, making memories. Right? New neurons help us make memories. And one of the main things that promotes neurogenesis is exercise. So that's another wholesome way, I think, to promote contentment. Okay, general factors for equanimity, and then let's take a lunch break. So I'll just name these, actually, and maybe we'll even do a little practice before lunch, right, to take us out here. I thought about what in the Dharma are some basic methods that are not specifically linked to these three systems of avoid, approach, attach. So I listed them here. Restraint. My own personal mode of psychological first aid, you know, crisis management, if you will, in the ER of daily life is pause, self-compassion, get on my own side, make a plan. You know, and all that kind of often happens with experience, you know, in 5 to 10 seconds. But step one is pause, right? We rarely get in trouble for what we don't do, right? Sometimes we do. But we usually get in trouble for what we do do. So pause, put the brakes on. You know, Tara Brach, friend and teacher of mine, calls it the sacred pause, right? As a couples counselor, boy, how many of you are couples counselors? You know, more than anything, this is what we want. We want them to slow down so they can be more mindful and be less carried away by reactivity, etc. Pause, restraint, sila. Self-compassion, critically important. A lot of research on that. You know, we got to start by having that sense of, ow, that hurts, yuck. It isn't, we don't wallow there, but then on the basis of, ouch, this hurts, I wish I didn't feel this way. Ooh, same kind of tender concern for ourselves that we'd have for a dear friend who's also in a pickle and who's been bumped by life. You know, then we can move on. Self-goodwill, a kind of kindness. Self-compassion is the wish that one not suffer. At root, self-kindness or is the wish or goodwill that one be happy, including a more general sort of being on one's own side. Steadiness of mind, that's another aspect of practice that I think has been underestimated when Buddhism initially came to the West, partly out of fears, I think, that Westerners, who tend to be performance freaks, included, would get self-critical and not practice if they failed initially at concentration and steadiness of mind. That said, there are three pillars of practice, not two, and one of the three is samadhi. It's the deep steadiness of the mind, which promotes insight. Because if the mind can't be steady, we can't really have liberating insight. Steadiness and liberating insight bring us to tranquility. Tranquility is a wonderful thing. It's a doorway to equanimity, inner peacefulness. The mind is still, has that quality like a pond. You know, tranquilizing the body, calming the mind. It's interesting when you read the description in the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta from the Buddha. Multiple times he talks about the step of tranquilizing something, bringing tranquility to the body, and then bringing tranquility to the reactions to the feeling tones and perceptions are embedded in what he said was the sufficient path to awakening, which is the practices of mindfulness of breathing. You know, okay? Tranquility is not apathy or deadening or numbing. It's just tranquility. It's really quite lovely, isn't it? I mean, it goes to the Buddha's line. The highest happiness is peace. Okay. Relaxing selfing. You know, the more that we get our own knickers in a twist, the more that we take things personally, the more that we make it about us, right? The more that we try to glorify ourselves and, you know, win the game of social standing and all the rest, the more we create the conditions for suffering. On the other hand, the more that we, on the one hand, respect ourselves as persons who have moral rights and moral standing and moral responsibility and deserve care, compassion, and kindness and wholesome support, and also the more that we can regard others as persons in the world altogether without getting personal back, without taking it like me, myself, and I, without getting I involved, again, the more that promotes equanimity. And then last, spacious awareness, which is where we'll do a practice here and wrap it up before lunch. Okay? So those are general factors, and there are slides about them. As I said in the very beginning, I'm going to move quickly through these general factors to buy time for us to really talk about aspects of equanimity that are more specific to these four, or three rather, motivational systems. All right? One thing I do want to do is show you one of my favorite song lyrics from Leonard Cohen. By the way, I got to do it. I can't help myself. So, you know, do you know the Rahula Sutta? This is the Buddha's advice to Rahula, his own son. No getting around the fact that the historical Siddhartha abandoned his baby boy and wife either during her pregnancy or shortly after the delivery and went off on roughly a 7-year path of awakening. To understand that, I think it's useful to put it in context. Nonetheless, it's a fact, you know, right there. Okay? The word Rahula means fetter. Can you imagine naming your child Fetter? You know, so on the other hand, in that tradition, there was a lot of emphasis on asceticism and, you know, the virtues of leaving fetters behind, as it were, and going forth. So be it. Those are the facts. And there are, I'm sure, many more facts as well that are relevant here that I won't get into. In any case, after a reconciliation or what have you occurred, after the Buddha's awakening, his son became one of his students. So Rahula here, no one knows how old Rahula is in the story. He's probably around 10. The back commentary is that he was caught doing something bad, apparently doing something wrong and then lying about it. So this is the Buddha's advice to his son, which I've condensed, but I've kept the original language as best I could, essentially to him. And I imagine the moment, I can't help it, I've got a son and a daughter, you know, 22 and 19, but can you imagine the Buddha giving you, you know, giving you a fatherly scolding? I'm feeling for Rahula here, you know. Wow. That said, what the Buddha said, I think is just fantastic. He basically said, look, before you do something, during doing something, and after you do something, and the something could be an act of body, speech, or mind, ask yourself, is this a good idea? In other words, is this going to help me and others or harm me and others? If yes, okay. If no, don't do it. And if no, and you did do it, go tell somebody. Cop to it, clean it up, and move on. Right? That's his advice. And again, the framing here is not moralistic. It's like the Uber coach, the ultimate executive coach, who's telling us this is what works if you're interested in the one thing I teach, the Buddha said, suffering in its end. Right? Pragmatically, if you're interested in suffering in its end, or less suffering and more joy and more helpfulness to others, this is a great strategy. I thought one time when I realized, you know, if you're doing this continuously, maybe that's why monks and nuns don't talk very much or do much, because, you know, it would really stop us from a lot of dumb stuff because we'd be engaged in this process. But it's not that bad an idea. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about this lyric I love. We don't have to be perfect to do this practice. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. You know? That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in. You know? We don't have to be perfect to do this practice. You know? We cannot perfect the mind. The mind will, you know, be the mind. Perfecting the mind is like trying to polish Jell-O. It's fundamentally imperfectible. Okay? So now I want to talk about, I'm moving through this stuff pretty fast. Please forgive me. I ask your forgiveness in advance. Okay. So, let's see. Spacious awareness. And the interesting thing is that there's been a lot of research these days on what spacious awareness consists of. So if you'll indulge me for about 15 more minutes, we'll take a lunch break after a little practice. Okay? So think about two modes of being that are fairly well known in this list. And I headlined one in quotes, doing, and the other one being. One mode is where we're representing things, often, you know, with images or with language. The other mode is sort of sensory activity. One mode, a lot of verbal activity. The other mode, very little verbal activity, et cetera, et cetera. You can see the list there. And you can see that these are paired opposites or held as opposites or two sides of maybe one coin that are very familiar here. Yeah?
I'm just curious why concrete is under being and abstract is under doing when you tend to think of doing something or doing something.
Yeah. Yeah, great question. So why is concrete under being and abstract under doing? Because a lot of doing is quite concrete. You know, brushing teeth is quite concrete. That's doing. I could have put other headlines at the top here. The one I really want is medial on the left and lateral on the right. Because everything in the left-hand column is related to activations of midline neural networks. That's a recent research finding. I'll show you some cool pictures in a second about it. And the states of on the right are associated with lateral activations, mainly on the right side of the brain. I put being and doing there because, and I'm ambivalent about it, but medial lateral is a little confusing for people in the beginning. To Deliberately stir the pot in a little provocative way. Maybe 50 years ago, maybe in some circles today, certainly a couple hundred years ago, there would have been two other headlines that have been frequently used at the top of these two columns. On the left-hand column, it would have been masculine, and the right-hand column, feminine. Or on the left-hand column, civilized. The right-hand column, primitive, savage, right? Them. See? And if you look at those two lists, it's really quite interesting. This is something I've really been kind of developing and mulling a lot lately and so forth. Modern civilization is a training in the left-hand column. Modern school, conventional schooling, is a training in the left-hand column. There's a place for that capacity, but much of the time, the left-hand column hijacks the right-hand column. Right? Because neurons that fire together wire together. If we're doing left-hand column activities, we are strengthening their neural substrates. So some pictures. This is a study that had people think about themselves in a very busy, self-referencing, verbal way. They lit up medial prefrontal cortex activation. That's the main point of this slide. All right. On the other hand, in this slide. Oh, I have a couple more here. Yeah, cortical midline areas for self-referencing thought. It's from a different study. The first one, yeah, is from one study. It's nice when a second study finds the same thing. The point is, when people are thinking about themselves, making plans, making doing self-referential problem solving, a lot guided by inner language, they're lighting up these midline neural networks. All right. In a very cool study, it was also found, though, that when people who are novices at this are asked to instead do something that's more being mode, like open, spacious mindfulness. For example, be aware of certain adjectives that could apply to oneself without, you know, thinking about them in a really detailed way as to whether they are true or not, or whether they were true then and not so true now, but instead just kind of be with the reactions that are triggered by those particular adjectives. They were indeed able to light up lateral networks in red in the lower right-hand slide. You can see networks lit up on the side. Blue is the doing mode, medial networks. Red is the lateral being mode, open spacious mindfulness networks. So untrained people were indeed able to activate those lateral networks for about 5 seconds. And then what happened is what we've all experienced in meditation. The midline network started getting going again without us even realizing it. There you are, open, spacious presence, great, breathing, thinking about the drama I saw last night with my wife called Miami Medical, kind of a mediocre drama with some very attractive people. What am I doing? Back to open, spacious mindfulness, right? Lateral, midline, ping pong, ding, dang, ding, dong, right? That's life. So, on the other hand, good news, with some basic training, 8 weeks of mindfulness training, 20 minutes a day, I don't forget, I think it was college students again, the usual subject group, people were much more able to stabilize lateral network activation, sustain being mode, right, over time, and therefore become more skillful and adept at being able to move nimbly back and forth between one and the other, rather than being routinely hijacked by the medial autopilot. That's the dominant paradigm, if you will, in our culture, in probably most sectors of it. Right? This takes us to a larger implication. You may be aware of the famous story of Bahia. This is from the Bahia Sutta. Apparently, Bahia was a teacher and very mature practitioner in the Buddha's day who sought the Buddha's teachings. So he traveled to come see the Buddha, who was apparently on alms round or doing something. He encountered the Buddha and said, "Please, noble sir, will you give me your teachings?" And the Buddha said, "Not now, Bahia." For whatever reason. Bahia asked a second time, "Please, really, could I please have your teachings?" And the Buddha said, "Not now, Bahia." And then for the third time, Bahia asked, "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" Apparently, traditionally, you're supposed to say yes after the third request. I myself, much as if I imagined the Buddha and Rahula, like what that was like, especially for Rahula, I imagined what it was like for the Buddha, wanting to move on, recognizing who Bahia was, and kind of basically saying maybe, All right, you want my teachings? Here they are, right? Kawum. And he said basically, Bahia, you should train thus. That's a really important phrase. You should train thus so that in the seen there is merely the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the thought, only the thought, and so forth. And when that happens, there's no you there. And when there's no you there, that is the end of suffering. Right there on the spot, supposedly Bahia was enlightened. Because that's the essence. And if you think about it, that's being mode. That's that lateral network. There's just presence with what's there. There's not selfing. There's not futuring or pasting. There's not commenting. There's just what's there is there. Right? That, just that, is the end of suffering. It goes to the traditional saying, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. We have many moments, actually, where we move into something akin to, close cousin, to the mind of a Buddha. Right? In that moment, there is no craving. There is no generation of the causes of suffering. There is indeed, perhaps as well, a deep contentment, a deep presencing. There's only this as this, you know, with contentment and tranquility. And just that is the end of suffering. And then we cultivate, you know. We stimulate neurons and strengthen them. So we cultivate gradually over time. Or as they say in Tibet, moments of enlightenment, many times a day. Right? Okay. So how do we actually do that? I should tell you at last the end of the story, supposedly, which for me adds credibility to it. Shortly thereafter, as Bahia was walking down a road, having left the Buddha, he unfortunately encountered an ox, which gored him and killed him. Now, why would they drop in that detail? I don't know. But to me, it adds credibility to the story. You know? What?
It's also the Darwinian thing, the ways in which this is constantly maladaptive.
Right, right. She's saying that it's, in a sense, maladaptive to be enlightened. Although, it could be that if Bahia were not so just totally lost in the moment of awakening, he would have noticed the ox, all right? On the other hand, the Buddha certainly, and numerous of his followers were considered to be, at least in the first, if not the fourth, stage of enlightenment in the Buddhist model, and they functioned very well. The Buddhists functioned very well in the world, you know, for 40 years. I think we have around us people who function very well in quite developed states of awakening, because it's not good to get gored by ox. You can't help others, let alone yourself. So I think both are true, yes. Trust in God, you know, and tie the camel, and watch out for ox, especially right after an awakening at the hands of the Buddha. You know, I asked a friend of mine once who was a monk in Southeast Asia for 9 years, what did he meet any enlightened people and what were they like? He said two things. He said, well, first of all, in that world of being a monk and really, really deep practice, you're not considered enlightened until people have lived with you for 10 years or so. Or as they say, you know, more prosaically, you think you have some spiritual game? Go home for the holidays. Hell is other people right there, you know. So I asked him, okay, fine. But did you really? He said, well, yeah, there were some people that were considered to be awakened or very close to it. I said, all right, what are they like? He said, well, first, they're very productive. They're just helpful. And I think that goes to the question earlier about, you know, what do people do when they're awakened or along the way? They don't check out. They don't lie on their pillow, you know, channel surfing all day long. They're engaged. They're active. You know, they participate. The second thing he said is that they're always the same. In other words, their way of being is unconditional. It's not contingent on conditions. In particular, he said, you know, if you treat them well, they really love you. If you treat them awfully, they really love you. Because their love, their state of mind, is not contingent on what's happening out here. You know, the worldly winds blow, but their keel is so deep in the water that they're just sailing their course. So, let's do a practice here to activate those lateral networks and get a taste of them. All right? So as it says here, there are ways to activate the two modes. You can see the list. Oh, thank you. No. Great question. I'm not formally recording this. Okay? We'll do this for about 10 minutes. I think you're probably already, most if not all of you, quite schooled in the lateral network activation. I'll just go through some kind of neat And not so obvious ways to light up those lateral networks that different research studies have detected. Obviously, we all know how to light up midline networks, like start wondering when I will finally, if ever, have a lunch break. You know, that will light up the midline. All right. Great threat and great opportunity tends to activate selfing and thus the midline networks. All right. And I would have wished for Bahia, much as you said, I thought very astutely, that he had lit up, had a little more midline activation and been able to avoid that ox. You know? But that said, we're all experts at midline activation. So let's explore the lateral side, if you will, of the tracks. So bring awareness just simply to your body and the sensations of breathing. Sensory awareness lights up lateral networks. You might even explore doing this with your eyes open, because it's nice to be able to tip into lateral activation in everyday life. And with an awareness of breathing, see if you can have, if only for a second or two at a time, a sense of the body as a whole. All the sensations of the body manifesting at once in a unified way in the field of awareness. This sense often crumbles after a second or so. Just regenerate it. A sense of the body as a whole. Abiding as the body, just sitting. Let yourself not know. In other words, you don't need to know what's happening in the mind. There's presencing with it, but not labeling or knowing, and not needing thoughts to stick together. Not knowing. It sometimes feel like a relief to let yourself not know, not understand. As this sense of the whole and not knowing deepen, perhaps, let there be a growing panoramic awareness, a sense of awareness as a vast and open space. Sometimes here it helps to close one's eyes to get a sense of, to realize that the field of awareness doesn't have an end to it. It's boundless, spacious. There's a kind of inherent bird's eye view, 30,000 foot view even, of the contents moving through the mind. You may already have been finding a growing kind of warm-heartedness, present in or arising in the open space of awareness, a warm-heartedness that has qualities of compassion for oneself and all beings, a kind of boundlessness of compassion, a non-restriction of compassion, present here in open, spacious awareness. Let the sense of this lateral mode, this being mode, quote-unquote, sink in. Let yourself recognize it to the extent it's been present, even for just a moment, so you can gradually find your way back here again. I think that people who are far along the path are actually quite supple at integrating the two modes. You know, the progress sometimes is to, first we have to differentiate and get a feeling and a clarity for the two distinct modes of being, and then we integrate. We can't integrate, though, until we differentiate. Okay, please stay here for about 3 more minutes because I've got 2 announcements I need to make. The first is with regard to what in the Buddhist tradition is called dana, which is generosity, essentially. And I'd like to draw your attention to something fairly concrete, first of all, and notice the lights in this room. All right? Having been on the board at Spirit Rock for some time, I can tell you with complete assurance that about a third of the lights in this room are paid for by donations only. In other words, about a third of the operating costs that keep Spirit Rock going, that keep the lights going, organize events, do the landscaping, maintain the retreat structure here, maintain the administration here, is enabled just through donation. People literally just gave. Spirit Rock is owned outright. We don't make a mortgage payment here. It was just given. This land was given, and the cost of the buildings were just simply given. That's we're here. We're here based on the generosity of people before us, stretching all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And he arose in part because of the generosity, in effect, paying it forward, of beings before him. So on the basis of that, I encourage you to just kind of think about the mode of practice that the Buddha actually had as his first teaching very often when he would move from place to place, village to village. He would talk about generosity as a really fundamental aspect of practice. Generosity promotes equanimity because to be generous, we have to have some sense of fullness and wholeness in the first place. And then through the process of being generous, in a wonderful way, it gives us the sense that the world is a safer place, that somehow we're more connected, We're more opening out into the world and present with it. So I encourage you to consider being generous to Spirit Rock. There's a Donna basket in the back of the room that, if you're so moved to give something that makes you happy, will happily receive your Donna. There are many forms of Donna, not just money. You know, attention is Donna. You've been very generous, really. This is complex material. There's a lot of it, a lot of talking, a lot of listening. You've been very generous with your attention to me and to other people in the room. Service. There are a number of people here who are volunteers. How many of you have volunteered sometime today? Raise your hand high, please. Thank you. That's Donna. We're here in part because of your generosity. And others, probably. How many of you have ever contributed to Spirit Rock, either with time or with money, a good word to a friend? Yeah, almost everyone in the room. That's generosity. So if you're so moved to participate in that flow of generosity for Spirit Rock, that would be wonderful. It's also the truth that I'm here generously, right, as a teacher. No one pays me to do it. The registration fees that you pay essentially are part of the two-thirds of what helps, you know, keep the lights on and the air conditioning working here, so we'll turn on the air conditioning probably in the afternoon. No teachers here are paid to teach, right? The teachings in the Buddhist tradition, particularly the more traditional Theravadin wing of the Buddhist tradition, are always given freely. It's not a quid pro quo. There's no "I'll scratch your back if you scratch my back" kind of deal. All right. For there as well, if you are so moved to offer some generosity for me personally, I will gladly appreciate it, very gladly appreciate it. And there's a basket to that effect as well. Money is good, bananas, dark chocolate, advice, I've gotten it all. All right, it's all welcome. It's all Donna. It's all beautiful. It's all great. You know, more and more I practice, honestly, the more and more I get clear about how really deeply important Donna is, how deeply important generosity is, as not moralistically framed, but pragmatically framed, as a really vital aspect of practice. It lifts the heart and makes us happy. It opens the heart and makes this world a safer and more beautiful place. Okay. Last announcement is a very practical one. During lunch, smoking is not allowed on the land. Also, be careful of the critters. Don't go past the gate. It's okay to eat in this room. There is the Woodacre Deli. You can go out and come, you know, go to it, get some food. It will be mobbed, so think about that and come back. I will start on time in 1 hour, actually 58 minutes, if you'll permit me, at 2 o'clock sharp. So take good care of yourself and see if you can explore sustaining a quality of equanimity while really enjoying life. All right? So that's your homework, to try to really savor pleasure equanimously. All right? Enjoy.